Last week we talked about Amos, and actually the last few weeks, the prophet Amos. He was not a prophet or the son of a prophet. He himself said he was a herdsman, and he raised sycamore figs in the area of Tekoa, which is off to the coast and south in Israel. Today we're going to talk about another. This prophet has probably written more metaphors, and we'll talk about what a metaphor is in a minute. More metaphors in his writings than probably any book in the Bible. You know, side for side, it's probably a lot more metaphors than anyone. So we're going to see that he was a contemporary of Amos. They both were sent to the northern tribes, and he was sent there too. And he was sent, but just right behind Amos. He was probably there, probably in the last 10 or 20 years of Israel's existence in the northern tribes before they were conquered by Tiglath-Pileser from Assyria and all the armies under their generals from the Assyrian army, okay? I'm going to read the first few verses of this prophet. So this is Hosea, the prophet Hosea. In chapter 1, verse 1, the word of the eternal, that's the YHWH, the word of the eternal, which came to Hosea, the son of Beria, of Beri, B-E-E-R-I, Beri, during the days of, and now here's where it's telling us when it happened, during the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, who were kings of Judah, and during the days of Jeroboam, son of Joash, king of Israel. So we know now that he's an 8th century prophet. He's in the 700s before Israel went into captivity around 721, 722 BC. What's the name of Hosea? Hosea's name, which occurs elsewhere, by the way, in the Bible, there's a person by the name of Hosea in Numbers chapter 13 and Joshua chapter 2 and also in 2 Kings 15:30. The last ruler in 2 Kings 15. He was the last ruler of the northern kingdom. His name was Hosea. It's derived from the Hebrew word that means help, save. And if you want to say it in the way they would hear it, he, Yahweh, has helped, has delivered. It's the name of, you know, the way the Hebrew works. So you see it, it's also in Jeremiah chapter 42, verse 1. Then all the commanders of the forces, Johanan, this I'm reading from Jeremiah 42, verse 1. Johanan, that name means Yah has been gracious, the son of Kareah. Then it says Jezaniah, the son of Hoshaya. That's the same word because how many English letters you put into the Hebrew words is also a difficult and flexible. The Hoshaya means Yah has saved. Yahweh, the eternal, the ever-eternal. Yah has saved. And all the people, both small and great, approached. Now this is Jeremiah chapter 42, that's verse 1. Chapter 43, verse 2, that Azariah, which means Yah has helped, and the son of Hoshaya, Yah has saved. That's again the Hosea's name, basically Hosea's name. And Joanan, it means Yah has been gracious, the son of Kareah. That Kareah means the bald one, the bald guy. It's not significant. And all the arrogant men said to Jeremiah, "You are telling a lie." Now, earlier, if you read Jeremiah in the context, you go up earlier into chapter 42. In the end of 42, Jeremiah is telling them, don't think you're going to escape to Egypt. Don't think you're going to get. Now, this was to Judah. Now, okay, I don't want to get you confused, because Jeremiah was not a prophet to northern tribes. I'm just using that for the names, so you see, okay? So very little, however, is known about Hosea's background. He doesn't give us much. Amos gave us a lot. He was a herdsman down in the area of Tekoa. He raised sycamore figs. He was not a prophet. He was not the son of a prophet. He says that, okay? But we don't know much about Hosea, except the name of his father, Beeri, B-E-E-R-I. While it is explicitly stated, while it's not explicitly stated, the ministry was certainly in and chiefly, mainly to the northern tribes, that is, Israel, as it broke the 10 tribes that went north, and they had their area of Samaria. And most probably, Hosea was also, unlike unlike Amos, a native of Israel, okay, not way down like a farmer, as it's suggested by his very intimate acquaintance with Israel. There's a note here, his mention and not acknowledgement of the northern locations. In the book of Hosea, he mentions Gilead in chapter 6, verse 8. He mentions Tabor in chapter 5, verse 1. He mentions Shechem in chapter 8. Verse 9, he mentions Gilgal in several chapters. He mentions Bethel. So he's very acquainted with all these places. So he may have been from the northern tribes, Israel. Amos was not. Amos was from the southern tribes, okay? The only direct evidence for dating Hosea and his ministry comes from the very first verse, which we read. He prophesied during the reign of these kings of Judah and during the reign of Jeroboam, the king of Israel. That's the only direct evidence we have. Other than that, we don't know, which accurately matches the contents of his book, though it does not mention the last kings of Israel under whom Hosea was most active. Okay, it doesn't matter, you know, the famous kings like Manasseh and some of those, it doesn't mention that. Okay, Hosea's ministry continued till just a few years before the fall of Samaria in 722 to 721 BC. He was right there. He's preaching, and teaching, and very much in metaphors. Hosea was the prophet of the final years of the northern kingdom, and his book represents beautifully written Hebrew, beautifully written and skillfully written, and emotionally packed with impassioned language, the troubles of those years. He was there for the last decade of Israel's existence. If you want a really good, I won't take the time to read it now, but if you want a better idea of the instability of the northern tribes, you could do no better than reading 2 Kings chapter 15 through 17. 2 Kings 15 through 17. You'll see the murders and the changes of kings and the way of the intrigue and the subterfuge and the deception and the underhandedness that was there among their kings and the way the government was very unstable. Hosea was obviously younger than Amos, but they were both sent to the northern tribes. And Hosea is written in two main sections. I can't read every word of the book of Hosea. It's such a larger much larger than Amos. But here's the way it ends up. The chapters 1-3 are a metaphor of marriage. And you'll see it. It's very intriguing. Chapters 4-14 is an evaluation of the political and religious groups that were there and the Northern Kingdom's last 10 years of existence. And then after that, you'll see some ideas that God's going to make them prosperous again. You know, this will not last forever. So the first one is a marriage metaphor. Like Isaiah went naked for about 3 years, walking barefoot and naked through Israel, through Judah. Okay, Hosea is acting out. Many prophets acted out their prophecy. And you'd say, well, why are you doing that? Why are you acting like this? Well, it's because the Lord is going to make you walk naked and you're going to be stripped and God's going to strip Israel from this and all that. So there were ways in which the prophet communicated through acting out rather than through just verbal or through written language. So Hosea is acting out the prophecy by a metaphor. Now, a metaphor refers to God's relationship with Israel by mentioning Hosea's marriage to Gomer. Now, a metaphor is a statement of something. Many years ago, I gave a little short message, some people call it a sermonette, of a light bulb. A light bulb, which was a metaphor for you, for a person. I use this light bulb to show how it had to have energy from the outside. It had to have this, and it could not light unless it had a filament that was doing this on. And I went on and on. But it was a metaphor for a human being, a spiritual human being who had the Holy Spirit flowing in him to make him light. We are the light of the world, and so on and so on. I use that as a metaphor. Okay. So Hosea was told to marry a woman of whoredoms or a prostitute. And he was supposed to have children by her. So he did. He married a woman by the name of Gomer, and she had three children. I want to give you their names here, and I'll talk to about a little bit. The first child was a son by the name of, they named him Jezreel, J-E-Z-R-E-E-L. Jezreel was the summer palace of the kings and the palace where Jehu killed Jezebel in 2 Kings 9. Jezreel was a very area, you know, where they, the summer palace of the kings, and they just went there and enjoyed life, and that was in the northern tribes area. So Jezreel, that first child is named Jezreel. The second child was named Loruara, okay, which meant not pitied or no compassion. You could say, in a sense, that child not loved. We have no compassion for that child. We have no pity for that child. You know, a child was a girl, and it was no pity. Not loved. The third child, again, another son, is named Lo-Ami. And talk about a really strong statement. Lo, A-M-M-I, Lo-Ami, means not my people. You're not my people. And he's acting out. He's doing all this in front of these people in the northern tribes. So let's begin Hosea chapter 1. I'm going to read from chapter 1, verse 2. We already read verse 1, all the way through to chapter 3, verse 5. And follow me with this, please. Hosea chapter 1, verse 2. When the Eternal first spoke through Hosea, the Eternal said to Hosea, when he first spoke through him, he's speaking through Hosea to the northern tribes. He said to Hosea, go, take to yourself a wife of harlotry. In other words, a prostitute, right? A prostitute. Some people say, well, was this a harlotry or was this maybe a woman who had committed adultery? No, I don't think so, because a woman who committed adultery wouldn't be alive much. But this is maybe a prostitute. And have children by her. Have children of harlotry. So your children are going to come from this harlot and you're going to have children of harlotry. And here's the metaphor. For the land commits flagrant harlotry, forsaking the Eternal. I want you to go and marry a harlot. I want you to have children by the harlot. Why? Because the land, that's a metaphor. Your marriage is a metaphor that means it stands for Israel. The land of Israel has committed flagrant harlotry by forsaking the Eternal. Ran off from their husband, ran off from the one who put them in position. One ran off from the one who provided for them, ran off from the one who took care of them, ran off from the one who got them that land, ran off from that. So I want you to have this. And that's the metaphor for Israel, because you want to marry a harlot, and then you're going to have children from her, because the land has committed flagrant harlotry in forsaking the Eternal. So he went and he took Gomer. He found a harlot. Nice name, beautiful name, right? Gomer. Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim. And she conceived and bore him a son. And the Eternal said to Hosea, name him Jezreel, for yet a little while, and I will punish the house of Jehu. You see it in 2 Kings 9, for the bloodshed of Jezreel. Now, God has not finished. God does not like bloodshed for nothing. Jehu killed Jezebel there. That's what he was supposed to do. But then he went on and he starts killing people and killing people. I'm going to punish him for the bloodshed, okay? I'll punish Jehu for the bloodshed of Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. Now, here we come again. Jehu was a king in Israel, and now I'm going to put an end to the house of Israel. So there's the threat. And it will come about on that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. Where will they go down? Where will they lose their strength? In the valley of Jezreel. So name him Jezreel. And it, all the things that are happening, because I'm going to get revenge on the house of Jehu, who went over the top. And this is also one of the problems. I mean, if you've read the book of, Shakespeare's book, A Tale of Two Cities, and things like that, you'll see how the French Revolution, it got out of hand. Yes, they had terrible rulers. You remember the famous statement by Marie Antoinette. People said, Madam Queen, the people don't have any bread. You know, they're starving. Well, let them eat cake. You know, which is a sarcastic uncaring, unfeeling statement. Are they going to eat cake? They can't even afford bread. Let them eat cakes. How stupid that was. She lost her head over that statement, by the way. And so here now we've come to verse 5, chapter 1. And it will come about on that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. And in verse, then she conceived again, Gomer. Now he's Hosea is giving his life to this woman, marrying a woman, naming his kids terrible things in order to carry out a message in action to Israel. And she conceived again and gave birth to a daughter. Now this time a little daughter. And the Eternal said to him, name her Lo-Ruhamah, which means without compassion or without love, without pity, you know. For I will no longer have compassion on the house of Israel. See the metaphor? She is the metaphor for God not having any more compassion. God got fed up. He's fed up. He sent prophet after prophet. He sent Amos. Now he sends the last days. He sends Amos. And Amos is powerful. He straightforwardly told them all your crimes and all that. And now here comes Hosea telling them, for I will no longer have compassion on the house of Israel that I should forgive them. No more. Okay. But I will have compassion on the house of Judah. Now there's a little statement. Didn't need to be here, but it's in here. I don't know why that was put in this prophecy, but he's really saying, Judas, I'll have compassion on Judah because Judah's still with me. Judah's still doing the sacrifices and doing all the things right. But shortly after this, we know in 722, 721, Israel went into captivity, but by the 590s BC, I mean the 690s, I'm sorry, when you get closer, maybe less than 100 years later, Judah went into captivity. And Jeremiah is saying, you're going in and you're going to go into captivity with Babylon. And there's nothing that God, you can do about it. So, you know, Judah at this time was still going, I will have compassion on the house of Judah in verse 7 and deliver them by the Eternal. They're not going to go, you know, from the Assyrians now. He's going to deliver them from the Assyrians by the Eternal, their God, and will not deliver by bow, sword, battle, horses, or horsemen, but by myself. He's going to kill the Assyrian army that came toward Judah, you remember, under Hezekiah. When she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, which means not pitied, and conceived and gave birth to a son. So when she finally weaned that girl, bang, here came another baby. Boom, like that. And the Eternal said, name him, that's another boy, Lo-Ami. I mean, what you talk about? Not my people. Lo-Ami means not my people, for you are not my people. Boy, that comes really strong. And listen to the second phrase, and I am not your God. I'm done with you. I mean, that hits you. You're not my people, and I'm not your God. That's done. We're done. We're done. It's over. Okay? Yet the number of the sons of Israel will be like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. And I will come, and it will come about in the place where it is said to them, you are not my people. It will be said, you are the sons of the living God. In other words, God doesn't totally get rid of them, right? Because he had a promise to Abraham, he had a promise to Isaac, he had a promise to Jacob for their descendants. And he's going to punish them, there will be no more. Now, what there was not going to be anymore was their kingdom, the kingdom of Israel. That's not going to be anymore. But where it said there, you're not my people, they will say you're going to be the sons of the living God. Because God just seems, you'll see in the book of Hosea, God seems to vacillate from, I'm going to kill you and you're not going to be around, to, oh, I can't really do it all. I can't really destroy you completely. And that's not, I mean, that's who God is, isn't it? God is mad at you because you sinned, but God gives forgiveness to you. When you and I go before the throne of grace and we say, asking God, please forgive us for our wrong thoughts or my bad attitude or my temper or whatever it was that you do, you expect God to forgive us. And God, yet God will be thinking, yeah, you should deserve punishment for this. So again, here comes and the sons of Judah and the sons of Israel will be gathered together. Another look at this in the future. The immediate is you're going down and you're going down hard. And the long-term range will be the sons of Judah and the sons of Israel will be gathered together. They will appoint themselves one leader. They will go up from the land, for great will be the day of Jezreel. Jezreel, that he names his son after because it's going to go down. Jezreel, but it'll be a great day for Jezreel. Okay? Hosea chapter 2, verse 1. Say to your brothers, Ammi, A-M-M-I, means Ammi, that means people, my people, and to your sisters, Ruhamah, love and compassion. You're going to have love and compassion. So chapter 2 then, God changes his tune again. You are my people. Say to your brothers, my people, okay? And contend with your mother. Contend, for she is not my wife, and I am not her husband. And let her put away her harlotry from her face and her adultery from between her breasts. So, by the way, in the law, adultery was punishable by death. You know, it wasn't just that you put away that. So, but here he's giving a metaphor, okay? Metaphors are not 100% exact the way things are any more than a light bulb represents you. It's not exactly the way you are, but it has certain similarities, okay? And you have a metaphor. For instance, one of the great metaphors is Ezekiel chapter 16 and verses 37 and 38. You'll see this metaphor from the book of Ezekiel. Therefore, behold, I shall gather all your lovers with whom you took pleasure, even those whom you loved and all those whom you hated. All your lovers, the ones that hated, the ones you loved, I'm going to gather them all together. So I shall gather them against you from evenly, from every direction and expose your nakedness to them and they will see all your nakedness. I'm going to strip your clothes off you. You're going to walk embarrassed. I'm going to bring all your lovers. Thus I shall judge you. Like women who commit adultery and shed blood are judged, and I shall bring on you the blood and wrath and jealousy. Wow. Look at the temper. Look at the thing. I shall also give you into the hands of your lovers, and they will tear down your shrines. You see, now it goes from human now to a tear down shrines of the country. Demolish your high places, strip you of your clothing, take away your jewels, and leave you naked and bare. See, again, it's a metaphor. Is would God really do this? Is this the way a man should treat a woman? I don't know. Okay. Now, in the law of adultery, you don't do that. Okay, the law of adultery is just plain. In Deuteronomy chapter 22, verses 22 through 24, it says this, if a man is found lying with, not lying with your mouth, but lying down with a married woman, then both of them shall die. So you cannot a man, okay, what was adultery? In the Old Testament, adultery was not a man taking a single woman. No, even if he had a wife, he could go and take a single woman if he could afford her and marry, because there was a polygamy. You could have more than one wife. You could have more than one marriage. But there were rules about that. You could only have that if you could afford a wife, because you cannot cut down her diet. You cannot save money by skimping on her food, skimping on her clothing. You have to be able to afford her. And if you could afford her and you want her, and you take, and she likes you and you want her, you take her as your wife, a second wife. And if you have her, it's not considered adultery. What's considered an adultery is taking another man's wife. And that's why what David did, and that's why God got so mad at David. I would have given you all these women. You could have anyone you want. But no, you had to take Uriah's wife. You had to take her. There are all kinds of women. But you took the woman who was the married to Uriah. And implied you went into her. You virtually raped her. And then you killed him so that she would be free for you. So, well, really, you killed him so that nobody would find out she was with child. Because her husband was away in war. That would have been trouble. So in the law, listen, it says, if a man is found lying with a married woman, then both of them shall die, the man who lay with her, with the woman, and the woman. No, she belongs to another man. She's married to another man, and she's having sex with somebody else. That woman dies. Thus you shall purge evil from the land. Verse 20, this is Deuteronomy now 22, verse 23. If there is a girl who is a virgin engaged to a man, now she's committed, she's going to marry this man, she's engaged to a man, and another man finds her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring both of them to the gate of that city, and you shall stone them to death. The girl, because she did not cry out, she's in the city. She did not cry out in the city and scream for help, which meant she wanted to do this. And the man, because he has violated his neighbor's wife. It's still, even though she's engaged or betrothed to this other man, she should have cried out, and she's considered his wife. Thus you shall purge evil from you and among you. Now the scriptures went on to say that if it's in the country and she's found out, hey, we don't know. And it's all from a human point of view. If she's in the country, what good would her to yell out? There's nobody around to help her, and he's got her. He may have raped her. He may have forced her into sex, and it's not her fault. Okay, so she gets out of it if she's in the city and she doesn't yell and scream for help, she's guilty too. Hosea chapter 2 now in verse 3. We came down to chapter 2. Lest I stripped her naked. This, I'm going to go back to Hosea 2, verse 1. Say to your brothers, am I, to your sisters, contend with your mother. Contend that she is, say, for she is not my wife, I am not her husband, and let her put away her harlotry from her face and her adultery from between her breasts. So now verse 2. Lest I strip her naked and expose her as on the day when she was born, I will make her like a wilderness, make her like desert land, and slay her with thirst. Now, please understand, this is metaphorical language. God would not expect any man, and especially in our modern times, to take action against a wife. Let's say a wife has cheated on a man. Let's say she had sex with somebody else. Do you do that? Do you take her and just take her in public and strip her clothes off of her and humiliate her? Do you do this to her? You make her like a wilderness? Do you make her like a desert land, and you're going to starve her, you're going to do this. This is not proper. These are metaphors. God would not do this now. He wouldn't want you to do this. You would have to negotiate. These are metaphors for Israel, not how God would act if he were a human. He wouldn't do this. He's going to do this for Israel in a metaphorical way. And I will have no compassion on her children. Well, you're not talking about a human. These are metaphors, because they are children of harlotry. Now, Hosea married a woman who's a harlot, and he had children of harlotry, and now he's saying, I'm going to strip her naked. I will not have any compassion on her children. Really? You won't feed them? You won't be nice to them? I mean, of course you have to. For I will have no compassion on her children, because they are children of harlotry. Because they're a metaphor for Israel, you see? Israel's the way. For their mother has played the harlot. She who conceived them has acted shamelessly. For she said, I will go after my lovers, who give me bread and my water, my wool, my flax, my oil and drink. Therefore, behold, I will hedge up her way with thorns, and I will build a wall against her so that she cannot find her paths. So she's still going to go out and find lovers. Okay, you want to take it away from me. You're my husband. You won't give me because I've committed adultery, but I'm going to go out and find lovers that will give it to me. I'll find them. I'll find liver. God. And, you know, there have been women who are addicted to alcohol, addicted to cocaine, and, you know, like men are. But let's say that their husband says, no, I'm not going to give you any more money to go out and go to the bars and everything. And some women have gone to the bars, and they offer themselves. You know, if you can buy me a drink, you can have me. You buy me a drink, I can be very nice to you. I can make you very happy. And if you give me some cocaine, I would do. And they do things like that. So, and she will pursue her lovers, okay? And she will pursue her lovers, but she will not overtake them. And she will seek them, but she will not find them. Then she will say, I will go back to my first husband, for it was better for me than there is now. In other words, God's going to intervene, because God has power. God can keep, again, this is a metaphor. She is a metaphor for Israel. And Israel's going to go out and look for something, and then they're going to have to either find a way or come back to him or be destroyed. For she does not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the new wine, and the oil, and lavished on her silver and gold, which they used for Baal. That means the nation. She used for Baal. The nation used it. The people used it. All this good. Therefore, I will take back my grain at harvest time, my new wine in its season. I will also take away the wool, the flax, given to cover her nakedness. I gave all this to her to dress her up, the wool and the flax that they made clothing from, and all that. So again, we cannot take these metaphors as the way a modern day husband should treat a woman who cheats on him. That would not be proper. And for the long time, people have read this and they've kind of got the idea, husbands, that how I'm going to treat her so bad. I'm going to be like God. Now God wouldn't do this. This is not how God would act. You have to act properly, because, you know, as a marriage counselor, as a psychologist, I've counseled many, many clients, many couples. A couple clients have been one of my specialties. And counseling couples, you find that whatever was wrong, and I used to have this statement to couples: every fault that I can find in my spouse, every fault that I can find in my spouse is in some way a fault of my own. because marriage, everybody, it's a constant interaction. Constant interaction. Every fault I can find in me is in some way a fault of my own. And if there is adultery, if there is infidelity, both men and women, you know, you say, well, it's all his fault, not my fault. It's all her fault, not my fault. Every fault, this is the principle that I work with. Every fault that I could find in my spouse is in, I don't say it's exact, I don't know what way, but in some way, it's a fault of my own. We don't know which way that is, but it's in some way a fault of my own. So just remember that. And so he says up here, and I will punish her as in for the days of Baals, for the day, because they took all my stuff and they gave it to Baal. Okay. And I will uncover her lewdness in, this is now I'm reading in chapter two, and now all the way down here, I will reading in chapter two, verse 10, then I will uncover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers, and no one will rescue her out of my hand. And I will also put an end to her gaiety, her feasts, her new moons, her Sabbaths, and all her festal assemblies, all the assemblies. These holy assemblies, you know, the holy day, the holy assemblies. Yes, I will put an end to them. They're going to have good times again. They're not going to be there. So God's going to really punish. But this is, again, a metaphor for Israel, not a metaphor. We can't look at this as a metaphor of the way a husband should act in actual fact. This is not the proper way of acting, okay? God is acting this way for Israel, but it's not a way that God would act or ask you to. You can imagine it would not be a way that Jesus would act. Of course not. All right. So we're going to stop there. We're going to pick it up next time because there's much more very interesting things in the book of Hosea all the way through chapter 3, and we're going to talk about that and then skip around to some areas of, and you're going to see what I call one of the fairest, it's interesting that it was here in the book of Hosea, one of the fairest statements about men and women, because there was not a fairness in the law about men and women. Okay, I'll just we'll mention that, and I'll show you what that is next time. Maybe you'll figure it out for yourself. Join me as we end today's services with prayer. Father in heaven, we give you thanks for your wonderful blessings. We give you thanks for the protection we have in our own country and the freedom that we have to speak your word without fear, to talk about your word straightforwardly, to accept it and understand it and understand what metaphors mean, and that don't mean what we often think of the reality. It's not the reality, it's a metaphor. And we have to be ready to accept the right way, the reality of behaviors and the way God does behave. And we'll see in Hosea how he talks about he is not a man that he would do some of these things, that he's God and he has self-control. And so we'll see some of these things later on. And we give you thanks now, Father, for everything. We ask your mercies and blessings on your people, wherever they are. Protect them, answer their prayers, hear their prayers coming up before you through that curtain of and into your throne. We give you thanks now for everything as we ask your dismissal and bring us back next week for more of your holy word in Jesus' name. Amen.